Welcome to Let's Finally Watch This, a podcast for casual movie fans who have always meant to watch classic movies. I'm your host, Nick Hayden.
And I'm your other host, Timothy Deal.
And this is our second episode of our third season. We need like a special title for this season.
Yeah,
it's a little different.
The abridged. Well, I wanted to call it like the abridged season, but like that has a different context on YouTube. Like, it's almost like a kind of a spoof. Yeah, then they do abridged versions of Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Dragon Ball. So, I don't know. The Cliff Notes.
The Cliff Notes version. The Spark Notes. The
the Sparse Season 3.
Anyways, we're 1914. And what is our movie, Tim?
Cabiria,
which I had never heard of.
Well, you had heard of it last season. I mentioned this briefly.
I probably have forgotten since then.
If you were paying attention.
I was not.
In our episode about 8.5. When we covered Italian history of Italian cinema. We mentioned that this movie was considered now the first film epic, but we'll get some more of that in a minute.
So, yeah. So give us a rundown. This is 1914. We're still in silent film era. What else do we need to know about what's going on?
Well, last season, I called this era in the 1910s kind of the adolescence of the film industry. It was still kind of becoming who it would wind up being.
And they're exploring about how to do things. Like, this movie explores the Zoom to a
certain
extent.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about theaters in America and such. So let's talk about a few things that went on in America, at least in 1914, in relation to film. This is the year that saw Charlie Chaplin really launch his career. We heard last time how he had gotten hired, but now his first film, Making a Living, is released on February 2nd, and his character, the Tramp, would come out in another comedy film. It was first introduced to audiences on February 7th, and it was called Kid Auto Races at Venice. That was really kind of the start of his career, and it would be a very good year for him. He'd be in his first feature film by the end of the year, come December.
Nice.
On February 8th is the release of a film called Gertie the Dinosaur, which is said to greatly advance film animation techniques.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know the details of that, but Wikipedia notes that. On March 31st, the serial Perils of Pauline begins.
Which we mentioned last season with...
We talked about how it was one of the first serial films that was kind of like that started, and here's another one of those. On May 8th of this year, 1914, Paramount Pictures is formed as a film distributor, and so they are celebrating their 110th year this year.
Yes.
On November 19th, William Fox's Box Office Attractions Company, which would later be the Fox Company, and then like 20th Century Fox, they released their first production, Live Shop Window. So, again, just a number of studios finding...
The coalescing of the movie studio not quite as we know now, but the beginnings of them.
That's right. Yep, there's just a couple notable examples of that going on this year. But we won't spend a lot of time on that today since we're going over to Italy. And I don't have a lot of Italy film history for you. Like, last time was kind of a wide view of it. We're not going to go that deep into this, but we will say that this movie, Cabiria, I think historians are kind of glad to have rediscovered it, because for a long time in American film discourse, The Birth of a Nation was referred to as the first film epic. But this one was the year before it, and it did get played at the White House and the White House lawn. From what I can tell, this movie didn't have as big of an impact in America, but it was certainly an influence for D.W. Griffith, the filmmaker who did Birth of a Nation.
Other filmmakers really enjoyed it, I believe, but he's the one I remember.
Yeah, this one is known for, and we'll touch on this, some of its innovative camera movement and just the big scope of it.
Very big scope, and it moves for 1914.
Yeah, and it was originally, the original cut of it was over 3 hours long, 3 hours, 10 minutes, something like that. The surviving versions now, there is an Italian version that is a silent film, Italian intertitles.
Yeah.
That is about 2.5. But for some reason, the one that's available in the U.S., the version we watched, is only 2 hours.
Yeah. Wow. What's the other half hour?
I don't know. That's one of those things. If I had more time this week and if we weren't doing our Cliff Notes version, I would have tried to do a deeper dive to figure out what exactly is missing. Other interesting thing about this is that they did do a restored version, like 3 hour version of it, that was shown at the Cannes Film Festival back in 2006.
Okay.
But for some reason, it was never made widely available to the public. Roger Ebert actually said in his review of it that the Criterion was working on a DVD, but as far as I can tell, that never actually happened.
That's weird.
Yeah, it is very strange. Now, I do think some of what was restored might have been kind of like, I don't know this for sure, but I got the impression that some of it was very rough looking.
Okay.
So that may have been a reason, like made me think of when we watched Lost Horizon and had some like just still shots with
yeah.
audio instead of a full thing. I don't know if that's sort of the situation here, but regardless, we watched the 2-hour version with English intertitles, which was pretty necessary for this. You'll hear more about that in a minute. It is available on YouTube. But yes, very influential. Again, on D.W. Griffith, Ebert himself would note that Griffith would take some of these ideas and do even more with
and,
them.
Yeah, and really moved it a lot more forward, but this was the building block.
Yes, yes. And also you can see some influences in Metropolis. Mm-hmm. Some people have said with like that movie has kind of this sacrificing people to Moloch sequence. And so does this movie.
Yeah.
So
it's a theme, I guess.
I guess. Moloch sacrifice. A classic tenets of world cinema.
Yeah. But yes. Apparently. Coming to a theater near you. Anyways, Tim, it is an epic. So it's a little convoluted at times, but can you give us our Cliff Notes, maybe thumbnail? What is it about?
Sure.
Who is this Kabiria?
And I don't know if we did this last episode, but we've decided we'll go ahead and do our recap outside of our strict 12-minute discussion time.
Well, last time was like, and they went places.
Yeah, it was a very, very short movie. This one's a bit more detailed, so we'll see what we can do. It's broken up into multiple episodes, and the first features a peaceful Roman family that has to escape the onslaught of a volcano.
Etna.
Mount Etna, yep. Yes. And in the process, the young daughter, Kabiria, and her nurse, they get stolen by Phoenician pirates and taken across the sea. In the second episode, maybe that's in the second episode when they get taken. Okay. Anyway, I'm going off my memory. I'm not going to worry too much about the episodes here. Eventually, a couple Roman spies in Carthage get word that this girl has been lost, and so they try to rescue her.
She's going to sacrifice Moloch.
Right.
And the nurse is like, help me, help me.
Yes, and they manage to rescue her from, like, there's this long sequence of, like, them putting people and kids in this giant idol that, like, has
flames,
like,
its
mouth opens, and, like,
it's pretty intense.
It is very intense, yes, for sure. But these two Roman spies, I should name them. There's Fulvus Axilla, a Roman patrician, and then the real hero of this movie, Maciste.
Who should really be, the title of the movie should be Maciste. he's easily the most enjoyable.
He is Axilla's, or Fulvius, do they call him Fulvius? I think so. Fulvius's African slave, basically. We'll talk more about him in a minute.
That might go into our discussion part.
Yeah, I think so. So they rescue her from being sacrificed, but they lose track of her, and I think she winds up basically in this noblewoman's house.
As a servant. Yeah.
And Maciste gets captured and is put to work for a while as basically a Samson sort of thing.
10 years.
10 years, yeah.
There's a 10-year jump then, basically.
Yes. So he's put to work grinding a millstone while Fulvius goes back to Rome.
Side plot about Hannibal.
Yeah, they kind of interweave some slide plots of that, basically the historical stuff that was going on. I kind of have a feeling that you would be able to follow it more if you knew your Roman history.
If you're Italian,
who and, this was made for.
And some of the later stuff, I feel like that's where some of the movie got cut.
Yeah, probably. I mean, some of it is just very, like, auxiliary, like the stuff with Archimedes and the battle.
Which is kind of fun.
But not really that important. It kind of touches on this main plot.
So in any case, Flavius, is that how you say his name? The Roman soldier.
Sure. Fulvius.
Fulvius. Okay. Anyways, he sneaks back into Carthage about 10 years later for
reasons.
For reasons. He rescues his servant, Maciste, and they don't see Kabiria then, though, do they? They have to get out of there. And you almost drown. No,
they get as they're trying to escape, they get stuck in the house, and it's convoluted.
I was trying to explain it to my wife the day after as we're traveling, and I'm like, oh no, and I forgot this, and she's like, I don't know what's going on anymore.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's probably like...
That's enough for what you need.
That's enough for a summary. This may be a sign that maybe I should actually write a brief recap of these to keep that quick.
Well, this one's different than some of them.
This one is particularly convoluted. But thankfully, you've got a nice through line with these two Roman spies and trying to rescue this poor girl who, when priests find out that, that girl that got away from us, we need to go sacrifice her. Poor Kabiria, but we'll get to that in a sec.
Okay, so I think that's all our facts, right? Are we ready for our discussion?
Sure, let's launch into this.
All right.
And I'm sure we'll probably bring up some things we learned in the process. But That is enough preamble. It's time to start the clock. 12 minutes starting now.
All right, Tim, so what is your general sense of this movie? How do you like it?
It's pretty interesting. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of names and events that kind of will get lost in the shuffle of things. But the center, the main thrust of these two guys and trying to rescue this girl.
And the noblewoman.
And the noblewoman, her whole dilemma.
Yeah.
We did joke sometime during it that Kiberia is just Italian for MacGuffin.
Because she is literally just hauled around places. Like, as a kid, they just carry her places. And even as an adult, they just carry her places.
She just gets thrown, or like, she doesn't really have much of a character. She's just the thing that we got to rescue.
Yeah.
So that's a little unfortunate. But the other characters, the other three main characters, are pretty interesting. But of course, Maciste is the guy we kept raving about.
He was amazing.
Because he's big and bulky and, you know.
He breaks chains with his bare hands.
Bends bars to escape from things. And he's the one who was also the most doting toward the Kiberia when they had, for a brief period of time, they were taking care of
her. He was a great, very interesting character.
Yes, he was. Now, the unfortunate thing is that the actor who played him was not actually African.
Okay.
He was Italian.
Okay.
So we got some blackface going on, but I would not have known that just watching the movie.
I would not have.
Because, you know, it's very different from American blackface, which was kind of a comedic thing that they would do gross exaggerations of facial features and things like that. They didn't do that here. And plus, the other thing you wouldn't think, because the guy is not wearing a shirt throughout the entire movie. He's pretty much bare chested, except for maybe a sash going over one shoulder. So that's a lot of paint to put on a white guy. But his screen charisma is definitely there. And
yes,
after this, he would go on to the actor wound up making a career out of Maciste, wound up actually legally changing his name to Maciste because he was such a character. And I think in some ways this inspired kind of a genre of Italian film, the big
sword and sandal sort of.
Yeah. Stuff. Yeah. Like this probably inspired the Hercules later on.
Mm-hmm.
The Maciste movies. See,
I saw there's like 20 of them before 1927.
Yeah, something like that. There was more after 1960s.
I heard that someone, when they got over here, they renamed Goliath or Samson.
So there's another big influence this movie had, and just in Maciste, the quintessential action hero who is way cooler than his master.
I mean, the master's okay, but he's kind of a goon.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah. I mean, he's fine, but.
Yeah, he's fine. He's just not near as memorable. Just every time we're like, more Maciste.
And I think that was what was so much fun for me. Like, you go into the old movie, you never know, like, is this going to be film history or is this going to be entertainment?
Uh-huh.
And this one was both.
Yeah.
I told my wife, I mean, like, I summarized it for my wife. She's like, yeah, that does sound really good. Like, no, it was a great story. I would tell Tim after we watched it, like, I could see them making, like, a streaming series. Like, you expand a little bit because the characters and the personalities and the events are all there.
Yeah.
Story-wise, it holds up really well.
Yeah.
I mean, it does get convoluted because of some of the history, but you give it a little more time or explanation, you'd be fine.
And again, we might have been missing some stuff from this shortened version that sometimes they're like, when the desert, oh wait, they're here now all of a sudden. And
there was action, there was suspense, there was humor. I mean, there's a time they're locked in a basement and they're like, well, we might as well start drinking.
Well, we're sequestered in a wine cellar. Well, what else are we going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
But the filming stuff is also quite fascinating to watch. The volcano sequence was pretty compelling stuff,
it was,
I'd say.
It really was.
Granted, a lot of cutbacks to the volcano kind of doing its thing. I don't even know how they filmed that.
No, it was pretty convincing. You're like, yeah.
It must have been like a volcano you make for a science fair project.
Yeah.
But the stuff with like the mansion, the palace
falling apart
and the big pillars, and it was very dramatic.
I mean, I know the Moloch scene is very famous because, I mean, it's intense, but like there's some really interesting like dreamish sort of overlays going on when they're coming in there, and it's kind of creepy.
It is. Janelle said that part was hard to watch, kind of disturbing, you know. Like, you know that this is something that ancient peoples did, but to actually see it, it's like,
the
devaluing of human life sort of thing.
And then apparently this is one of the first movies that zoomed, right?
Yes, the camera does do some moving here, which we had seen.
And everyone's over like, oh, it's moving. Because
And to be fair, it's not the first movie that has done kind of dollying back and forth. I mean, we even saw that last season in The Great Train Robbery, a little bit of that. But this one is notable for having some where the camera moved in on a person, you know. Where,
like for dramatic reasons.
For dramatic purposes, yeah. Again, I think D.W. Griffith would do this a lot more in his movies that came right after this. The Birth of a Nation, of course, and then also Intolerance, which is 1916, which has a Babylonian sequence that is probably highly inspired by this movie, okay. Particularly the ancient setting. But yeah, the idea of moving in on a scene to get a better view of characters, what's going on in there, and not just being able to see what's going on around you. I mean, being able to move the camera back and forth and take in more scene, going from one setup to another setup and all in the same shot, certainly adds to the illusion of reality.
Yeah.
But then going forward, moving the camera in as in kind of a zoom, brings you more closer in on characters that are going on in there. So, yeah, very innovative.
And the shots were just, I mean, they would scale walls and they'd jump off cliffs and they there's just a lot of big scenes.
I mean, Roger Ebert's review pointed this out. The battle sequence on the wall.
Yeah.
If you think about that in comparison to, say, your Lord of the Rings, where there are some actors doing stuff, but there's a lot of CG. This is all real.
Yeah.
Those are all real people, like climbing ladders and falling down and they do that big thing where a bunch of guys make a human pyramid, basically, to scale really one wall.
It's kind of impressive. It's like you're watching some sort of talent show.
Yeah. And like, but no, those are actual people doing that. So, I mean, that's one of the fascinating things about watching these older movies, just thinking about...
People did it.
Yeah, it's not fake. They actually did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something else.
And it just, I guess, story-wise, as a writer, it felt epic in that sense of, like, you have all these interlocking characters, and they have their own missions, and they go back and forth with each other, and, skip time, and the innkeeper has consequences. Everyone, and that's something we talked about at the end, like, everyone seems to have their consequence. Like, there's no, like, they're not trying to, like, put a moral in this movie necessarily, but really, everyone kind of gets what they deserve, one way or another.
I mean, that is an interesting thing about the politics here, because... Nominally, our main characters are the good guys are Romans, essentially, because Italians. But the movie acknowledges that when the Romans conquer you, it's not really a great thing.
No.
Like,
and not all the Romans are great.
No, and not all, even in this movie, that's probably true.
So the pre-consul was like, I'm just going to take that lady as my wife.
Yeah, it's like, yep, she's my prize, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the ancient world for you.
Yep.
Yeah, it's honest about that kind of stuff. It's not completely whitewashing that the Romans were a bit barbaric in their own way.
Yes, yes.
At least they weren't sacrificing kids to...
No, luckily not.
...fiery doom.
Unlike the Phoenicians, apparently.
Yes, apparently. Well, let's see. We still got about 3 minutes left, Nick.
Oh, wow. We just speed through this.
We've been very economical here.
All right. So what... we haven't talked much about the noble lady. Is it worth mentioning her? Because she's a very complicated...
Yeah, she is an important character, I think, to talk about. Because, like, at time, she gets convinced to take Kabiria into her home.
And she's in love with this Masisina. I think that's his
name.
Other guy who ends up working with the Romans. And it's... But she's kind of conniving, but she cares about her servant, but she also is worried about the gods.
Yeah.
And she's one of those kind of like Shakespearean, like power hungry, but conflicted. I mean, she's not like a protagonist like our two
people, but she's
interesting.
But yeah, my feelings toward her shifted over the course of the story. Mm-hmm. Cause sometimes like, oh, she's a nice benevolent noble as opposed to these evil priests.
Yeah.
And later on, it's like, oh no, she just like completely backstabbed, like gave her up and like basically to save her own skin.
I mean, she has this whole love story that you feel good, bad about. And then you're like, wait a second. And she's just pulling strings and she's a little ambiguous.
Yes. A good kind of complicated and kind of showing some of the moral complexities of this whole situation.
Mm-hmm. The ending we thought was a little, there was one thing we wish would have happened. Because like she's been gone from her parents this whole time. Her parents show up midway.
That's true.
Through like the Roman soldiers, like, hey, I saw that lady. I'll see if I ever find her again. I will help you. And then they're going back. They fall in love because that's what happened. Kabiria and the Roman. But like she never gets back to her parents. I mean, you assume they do, but it was a weird like setup that never got paid off.
Yes, that was strange.
And nowadays, I think you probably would have.
You probably would. Yeah, that's just strange not to have. I mean, if anyone deserved it and was invested to see Kabiria returned, it was her parents.
Yeah, Kabiria really, I mean, the main flaw character-wise, we're talking about all these great characters, is that Kabiria
is not one.
Is not one. She really isn't.
She's just the title character who gets passed
around. She hardly ever talks, does she?
Not that I remember. I mean, it's funny. There's a lot of intertitles, but not a lot of them are dialogue. Some of them are just setting up locations and things. It's interesting. Sometimes they'll actually describe a scene just before you see it.
Which was really helpful. Like, I've not watched a ton of these silent movies. This one's political and complicated, so they would tell us, and then they show it, and I'm like, oh, it was a nice style. Worked. Yeah. I think we would have been lost if they had flipped it.
Yeah, I think so. It was a very unique feature to this sort of, like, it kind of reminded me of like a reader's theater or something. Like, this feels very unique to this art form to do it this way.
Yeah.
And unique to this time period. Yeah, most silent films later following this, I don't think would do intertitles quite the same way. They would tell more through dialogue rather than setting up the scene so much. But it worked in this case. Granted, a lot of, you know, things that we're saying, like Kabir is not really a character, we give leeway for in that this is 1914.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're doing a 3-hour epic when this had never been done before.
And everything, so much of the story works.
Yeah. There's a reason why it stands the test of time. So, all right, that is our time, Nick.
Wow, we're doing pretty good at this.
Yeah,
we haven't got to a philosophical one yet. That's true.
We haven't really
done an 8.5 or Unforgiven or something yet.
That's true, and we're not really asking the deep questions that we would prepare. No. So, but that's okay. I think we got covered a lot of ground. So that is Kabiria.
Yeah. So, final verdict. Would you recommend it?
I think I would recommend it. I mean, again, know what you're going into.
It's a silent film, but it's a great...
Well, not just silent film, but like a very early silent film.
Yeah, I would agree. As long as you know what to get into, I think it's very watchable.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess if you compare this to the 1923 epic film we watched last season, The Ten Commandments, which is really only like half epic.
Yeah.
How do you think this one compares to that?
The whole movie or just the Egyptian part?
Well, I guess we'll just say the Egyptian part because, yeah, the second half of Ten Commandments is like a whole different movie practically.
Like an hour and a half of it. But what it feels like. I don't know because, like, Ten Commandments, the first half, the original 1923 version, is more epic in senses. There's more people, more going on.
Mm, sure.
But I don't know. I'm really fond of this one. I really enjoyed Kabiria. I would easily show someone, as long as they're okay, like, this is 1914.
Yeah.
But it's very entertaining. I mean, this outsider talking, the music was kind of fun sometimes. It was like, it was very, really cheery and it should
have been. That's true. At least the version we watched a version with just a piano, which I think it was piano.
Wasn't it the original?
Based off the original score. But I think the original might have had a full orchestra.
Oh, okay.
Or something.
Okay.
But yes.
I'd say absolutely, as long as you know what you're getting into.
Yeah, I concur.
Well, that has been episode 24 of Let's Finally Watch This. That was Kabiria. We'll be jumping a decade to 1924 next with Sherlock Jr.
That's right. A Buster Keaton movie.
Which I've never seen Buster Keaton.
I've not watched much, so it'll be fun. In previous seasons, our 1920s films have been a horror movie in Nosferatu and then in an epic film with The Ten Commandments. And this will be a comedy, which is more what I'm used to for watching 1920s silent movies. Yeah. I haven't watched a ton, but I know my Charlie Chaplin at least. So this will be fun.
All right. I guess until next time, this has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.